Just very, very finally, and to stray entirely off my regulatory subject, but just to offer a personal view, I would pick up on the comment of the previous speaker about the relevance of modelling extreme events where the events themselves have fallen outside the insurable envelope. Even where events are not insurable, even where they are borne by society as a whole, perhaps especially where they are not insurable, and especially where they are borne by society as a whole, there is a need for price formation about those risks. There is a need to price those risks. If we have the direct bearing of risks by non-profit seeking entities such as the society as a whole, without some understanding of the pricing of those risks, that can, of course, as anybody knows from basic economic theory, lead to economically suboptimal decisions. But I would go beyond that, and I would say, actually, as soon as one actually has a little bit of pricing information about risk, then I think even that extreme type of non-diversifiable risk that is traditionally regarded as not insurable is potentially capable of being laid off into the financial markets, even if the traditional insurance markets do not find themselves able to accommodate it. One just needs to look at the sort of aggregate risk that the more or less random walk in the global financial markets, to see the random walk on any one day is actually a greater magnitude than many of the greatest so-called operational risk or occurrences that occur. That was all I really wanted to say. Thank you.
Right, we have our next contributor.
Louise Prown. I'd like to thank David for a very interesting and wide-ranging paper. And I was particularly interested in a point which arises from his statement in paragraph 2.5 that extreme events are relative to the entity. That is clearly true. A car accident is an extreme event for me. I expect not to have met very many this year, indeed in my lifetime, with any luck, but is clearly not an extreme event for a motor insurance company. The assumption throughout most of the discussion this evening has been that we really only need consider as extreme those events that sort of end up at the end of the risk-passing chain, so that we needn't use extreme event techniques for individual car accidents, because actually, if you're an insurance company, you've got enough data that you can use standard techniques. Previous speakers have also mentioned operational risk. We know that in operational risk there are indeed a large number of high-frequency, low-impact risks. A lot of claims handling risks fall into this category. But there are other operational risks that are extreme for individual companies that are not insurable or not currently insurable, but which, taken across the economy as a whole or a particular industry sector as a whole, are probably not extreme. However, individual organisations at the moment, if they are doing any using any quantitative methods to assess these risks, would have to use extreme event techniques because they do not individually have enough data. I think this really emphasizes the need, or the desirability anyway, of trying to do some industry-wide data collection on operational risks so that individual organizations can make more accurate assessments of those events which might be extreme to them but are not extreme to the industry as a whole. Thank you.
It's Roger Jackson. I'd just like to make a couple of comments from the discussion this evening, really on the practical side rather than the technical modelling side as far as the calibration goes. We've heard about the data issues regarding EVT modelling and the difficulties as far as the time variable of the data sets we look at, the covariance are involved, and the lack of data that's generally available to try to calibrate to a 1 in 200 type event. I think that whenever you have a situation where there is very limited data, obviously you need to go out and try and find as much as you can from whatever sources that are available to you. And in this instance, I think it's incredibly important for us to talk to the people that probably know the risks more than anybody else in a particular company. And I'm putting this in the perspective of the new regulatory requirements as far as capital is concerned. So I think in that aspect, trying to get input from the different departments, from the companies, from the finance department, the reinsurance area, the risk area, the human resources and the actuarial, and trying to pull that information together in some sort of framework that everybody understands is probably one of the most important things I see coming out of the regulations from capital. This information, obviously, you need to put it in a form of framework that everybody understands, and so that when you start talking about the type of events you're looking at here for 1 in 200, people start to think about them in the right way. From previous experience, this is difficult, and it takes some people some time to understand what you're trying to do from this exercise. And also, it's very illuminating as well, I think, from different people as far as when we talk about covariances, for example. When you start talking to people in the same room about this, you certainly immediately come to the conclusion that there are causes and events here that will affect different areas of the operation and that you should certainly consider when looking at 1 in 200 type events. For example, on an operational risk side, I'm sure the has been well documented that the operational risk side for the Leeson road trader was due to multiple type events rather than one just single failure of an operation system. So I think also historical examples in a practical framework are useful as well as far as getting people to understand the types of things that can happen, and I think the paper goes through some of these in detail. As far as EVT modelling is concerned, I think that has a place as well in pushing forward our theoretical concepts of how we might model these types of events. However, I always think there's a danger that sometimes we may get too far away from reality sometimes. So I think I would say personally that I think a two-pronged attack is really the answer here. Definitely to understand and model some of these events in a lot more detail, but also go back to basics really and talk to the people involved and try to assess from an empirical way as far as exactly what they think the potential loss from a 1 in 200 year type event is. I think this is particularly poignant when you think about business planning as far as trying to link through the new regulatory regimes to business planning. A lot of the business planning, it's difficult to get right on a deterministic basis, let alone trying to simulate thousands upon thousands of business plans to try to generate your 1 in 200 year event. So I think, in summary then, what I'm trying to say is that EVT modelling, I think, has a definite place as far as our understanding goes. As far as calibration is concerned, I would also like to think that we could go out and make sure that we get as much information to calibrate these models as possible from those people that understand the risks the most. Lastly, I'd just like to respond to Louise on about an operational risk database. I am aware of one such operational risk database in the insurance field that the ABI are currently setting up in collaboration with the SAS Institute, and I'm sure they've got a number of insurers dedicated to that now, so just to let you know. Thank you.
I just wanted to thank the Institute for the invitation, very much appreciated, and to thank the author of the paper. I just wanted to touch on a couple of areas, certainly of the work of ABI on natural catastrophes, where the paper has a lot of relevance. One is very much global in scale, and one is perhaps more local in scale. And the first one relates to climate change, which certainly is covered in the paper. And the best information we have about climate change is that the frequency and intensity of extreme events will increase. Certain kinds of events will increase. And so one role that certainly we see the insurance industry as having is helping to quantify the risks of these events in the future and helping society understand the different options it has for managing those risks or potentially mitigating those risks. So some work that we're taking forward at the moment is to try and link up the current catastrophe models in different parts of the world with the best climate science to try and quantify what the potential costs of climate change could be in the future under different kinds of scenarios. So a sort of Kyoto business as usual scenario where emissions keep increasing or potentially a scenario where we take very proactive action to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere, and a scenario where we also prepare for the impacts of climate change that are already built into the climate system, such as building better flood defences. So this is some work that we're hoping to complete later this year, and hopefully it will have some useful implications also for the capital requirements in the future as well, and we're working with the two big reinsurers on this project to help understand what the implications of climate change could be to climate change if you have more volatile events in the future, either of increasing intensity or greater frequency. What does that mean in terms of the capital requirements of either insurers themselves or of reinsurers, and will there be other kinds of alternative risk transfer mechanisms that begin to develop and certainly that are starting to develop and also touched on in the paper? The second point I wanted to make relates to some of the work we've been doing about London itself and the risk of flooding in London, which has certainly been with us for many years. The real challenge at the moment is that East London and further downstream the Thames has been identified by the government as a key area for a lot of the additional housing that we need in this country and for some reason in the southeast particularly. And of course a lot of this housing is in the floodplain and will increase the risk, the true risk of flooding in London and for the UK. What's very interesting about that scenario and why it particularly relates to the sort of issues of extremes is that London itself and that whole area, the Thames Gateway, is better defended than any other part of the country. That the chance of a flood in most parts of that area is about a 1 in 1,000 year event. Actually, the Thames Barrier at the moment is still at a 1 in 2,000 year design standard. But what's very difficult about that is that when you have a well defended area, in a sense, it also encourages more development behind defences because people feel that they're well protected from flood risk, so it's all right to build there. And the challenge for the insurance industry, of course, is that the aggregation of risk increases. So although the chance of flooding in London or Thames Gateway remains or will potentially go down with climate change unless we actually do something about it, the actual aggregation of risk increases. And what's very difficult about that from a government policy perspective is how do you actually plan for an extreme? Do you put more resources? Do you build your seawalls even higher to make sure that you reduce the chance of a flood? But of course, you can never completely eliminate the chance that a flood will come. And so we've had some very, very interesting discussions with the government about how do you actually plan for an extreme event? Should you worry about it at all, or should you just assume that it would never happen? I think the paper presented today certainly has a lot of very relevant public policy implications as well, and so I'm very pleased to be here and hear about the developments. Thank you very much.
Anybody else like to contribute to the discussion? If not, then I invite Michael Tripp to close the discussion.
Thank you, Mr. President, and thank you, David. Thank you, David. I think we've all heard all the speakers have said. Yet another magnificent contribution, David, from yourself. Timely, broad and accessible, but creditably brief, I think I heard somebody say. Builds a lot on your previous work, practical, down to earth. I think you, sir, must be indefatigable, if that's the way you pronounce the word. So thank you very much for the contribution on behalf of everybody. Maybe I could just pick up some of the themes that have been raised tonight in terms of the maths. We heard a lot about the importance of stating underlying assumptions, some of which can be very strong, and the hypotheses, and recognising that the circumstances we're trying to model may sometimes, if not always, fall foul of these assumptions, whether it's an independent identical distribution, stationarity, whether it's to do with the normal spread or non-normal spread, and there's a lot of discussion tonight about the linkages that go on, the cause and the effect, whether we're talking about linkages through human behaviours, the weather, geology. We've had a very wide-ranging discussion, and it always leaves me at a moment like this and just saying, well, can maths ever help? Can we ever hope that maths can solve all these problems? And it's just one of those things that when you lie awake in bed at night, you sort of could think, we'll say a little bit more about modelling in a moment, but we have to be mindful of this sort of tension between statistics, maths, and the physical side of what we're trying to model. We also heard a lot about parameterisation. We're trying to parameterise from very limited data, and there are all sorts of issues that arise from that, and the importance of stating the limitations on our estimates of parameters came through. And I was too going to mention ORIC, whilst we were talking about operational risk, but that's the ABI database. All I'd say is if you're in a company and you haven't subscribed, it's probably worthwhile thinking about that. We heard... I was interested to hear that we didn't have a lot of discussion about alternative approaches. We were talking about the maths, and in the paper, David talks about self-organising criticality. He talks about chaos theory. He talks about complexity theory. We heard a little bit towards the end, you know, combining physical climate models with the mathematical modelling. And, you know, maybe this is an area for us to look at a little bit more in the future. Still, I don't want to take away, David, from your closing in that respect. We had quite a lot of discussion about what I put down here under the heading of society, policy, politics, and pain for risk protection. We heard about mitigation, the interplay between where does capital end, the importance of capital, and where does mitigation start. We heard about the difference between planning and plans, the fact that plans themselves may not be very helpful, but the whole thought process of going through the planning thought process can be. We heard that mitigation is important, but we also heard that mitigation itself can lead to change in behaviours, and if you like, undo the effect of the mitigation, whether that's in the Thames flood area or elsewhere. So again, this whole cause and effect thing comes through. We heard, I think in the paper, David talked about areas of the world becoming generally wealthier and the scope for extreme events in terms of costs increasing becoming bigger and bigger all the time. This itself is a feature when we're parameterising our models that sometimes we find difficult to allow adequately for. In fact, one of the things that David was saying, very often we end up underestimating the effect of extreme events. We had a very interesting input from Paul Sharma from the regulatory point of view, And I must admit, I was getting slightly confused during the discussion about the difference between modelling a one-in-year, a one-in-200-year or one-in-N-100-year event versus the possibility of a company going out of business with a certain probability in a particular given time period. I guess there is a difference, and maybe sometimes we're all guilty about using the two things sort of a bit interchangeably. Maybe there's some thinking there about, do we really mean we want the insurance industry to be able to take completely on board a one-in-200-year event, or are we talking about the risk of an insurance company becoming insolvent owing to management action rather than through random external actions? I was pleased to hear some reference to the fact that actuaries should be taking steps towards helping banks in their modelling and thinking. Equally well, there's probably a two-way process here because the actuaries themselves should be learning from other professions. That would lead on just to summarising some of the things that were said about professional matters. We heard Andrew Smith. I'm afraid, Mr. Secretary, I'm not sure which Andrew Smith it was that made the contribution. I have learnt the extreme event theory doesn't actually talk about modelling how many Andrew Smiths the Institute might have. But one of the Andrew Smiths was talking about guidance on what the acceptable parameterisation is. And I do think that the Institute, that's ourselves, you know, we are the Institute, have to think more about sharing. And we heard the idea about having a workshop, a one-off topping up. I'm sure there's so many. As I get older, I keep thinking, oh gosh, I'm glad I'm not doing the exams tomorrow. But there are so many subjects, and this would be one of them, where a one-off topping up rather than continual professional development might well be an issue for us. Just to sort of come towards trying to pull the threads together, as a profession, we do have the challenge of making sure our thinking is not misunderstood. Sometimes what we say gets taken too literally. Sometimes we may be a bit narrow in what we're saying and may get misunderstood. Models are there to help. Coming back on one of the themes from earlier on, models are there to help to give insight. They're there to help us be clear and to understand things better. I remember growing up through Gyro, and Sidney Benjamin, bless him, would often say, there's no point saying something if you can't explain it in words of one syllable. You need to understand things that clearly that you can explain them to anybody. And when we're using complex models like this, we need to understand exactly what we're modelling so that we can use the models to help explain, but we can actually also put it in the context of clarity and of being able to communicate and present well. So I think there's some challenges there when we talk about uncertainties. How do we actually make sure the uncertainties, and as I think Professor Cole said, you know, we're talking about a range of plausible answers maybe more often than the single best estimate. Unfortunately, we're talking to a world that really just likes to latch on to single best estimates, and so this whole communication activity is really important for us, and there's a theme there that we need to work on. I've probably rambled on myself, David, far too much in trying to extract some of what was said through the presentation. It is a very timely paper. I think you were saying earlier on it's actually your third paper to the Institute, so you know we owe a debt of gratitude to you. Somebody once asked Harold Macmillan, why do things not turn out as planned? And he's reputed to have said, events, my dear boy, events. Well, maybe if he'd been here tonight, he would have said, extreme events. David, I'm not sure I should call you an extreme event, but you have done an extreme job for the Institute. Thank you for that, and invite you to respond to the comments that you've heard.
Thank you for all your various comments. I now have difficulty in trying to read my own writing. Wendy started off by commenting that I said something about CAT models being not very good. Well, that tends to be the case from my experience. The CAT models that are used for modelling purposes often underestimate, when you see the first estimate, the actual cost by a considerable factor in extreme events. For the majority of events, they are fine, but from my experience, and anybody who reads the press that follows this up will find, they underestimate. I have a different view. I always overestimate. It's a natural thing for an actor like me to do, being pessimistic. I share Ian Cohen's view, the need to understand the process. That is actually pretty fundamental. Statistical modelling per se is not enough. You have to understand. You've got to go read books on geology and see the mathematics there. That will blow your mind. The Earth is stable, I agree, but it is also very restless, to paraphrase Nigel Calder's marvellous book, which actually drew me to the attention to this back in the 1970s. Recommended reading for anybody, and if anyone sees that documentary, which was done then, you'll see the revolution that was taking place. Professor Coles, thank you for your wide-ranging contribution. You mentioned in there a number of things. The covariate effects, I think, you actually pulled up, and I think these are quite important. Because one of the things I learned many, many years ago when trying to model these was the relationship between different events. For instance, if you have an earthquake in Los Angeles, the actual cost of the earthquake is dependent on which way the wind is blowing and how strong. Because the fire after the earthquake can make a difference in the cost for the same earthquake by a factor of 4. And that was actually known many, many years ago. So understanding this relationship is important. And I agree also the comment, the importance of uncertainty. If you tell people how uncertain your estimation is, they place little value on it, unfortunately. And Bayesian statistics, I think, is the case when we watch this space. We're going to try to do something on Bayesian statistics in this concept, but it's not for this audience. It will be for for another place. Ian Reynolds, thank you very much for your contribution. My office got blown up as well, twice. I have one more claim to flame. I was actually sitting on the train outside Canary Wharf when that one went off. So I've actually got 3 events to your 2, which is... these are the sort of issues that we do try to understand and look at. And I also share the view, I think Professor Embrex also shared, and many of us share, regarding operational risks, that it is often not a capital issue, it is a management issue. And management themselves ought to put in the self-mitigation process and not necessarily run to capital to actually solve the problem. That covers Paul Schager. Louise Pryor, again, thank you for your contributions. There are lots of things I could have put in the paper. In fact, on one of the drafts, I had so many things down that he was, I'm wondering. The classical case is a computer breakdown. We saw that actually happen with the banker which relied on it. And the consequence of that on their business is that astronomical. And yet, if they don't plan for it or don't understand it, then, of course, they won't react to it. There are issues out there which can be modelled by these sort of approaches or some of the formulations that I put forward. That is all done. Finally, I'd like to thank sort of people who haven't mentioned. I will actually be responding in writing. But I'd like to say that I saw the programme last night on telly on the tsunami that actually hit the West Coast, right where I live. I said, thank goodness I moved 5 years ago. I am now 300 metres up, so I'm mitigating myself against that risk. Thank you very much for all your contributions.
Thank you very much, David. It now falls to me to express on your behalf thanks to the opener, Wendy Hawes, and the closer, Michael Tripp, and to our author, David Sanders. David is obviously a very, almost a polymath. I think he's quoted from Rousseau and from Alan Greenspan. He's told us about chaos theory and self-organising criticality and all sorts of things I didn't know about until I read this paper. He's got an encyclopedic knowledge of past events, extreme events across a wide range, and he's even slipped in some applications in areas of finance and mortality. So really quite an astonishing paper, and I think we're as other people have said, owe you a great debt of gratitude. I'd like to, before I close, just echo Michael Tripp's comments about communication and communicating uncertainty. I came across this when I attended a meeting of the General Insurance Board for the first time in my life last autumn, and was surprised to find them talking about uncertainty. I had come across it in my background in terms of long-term savings and trying to explain uncertainty to members of the public and trustees of pension funds. And then a few weeks into my presidency, I attended a meeting of the Executive Committee of the Continuous Mortality Investigation. And they were talking about uncertainty around mortality, future projections of mortality. And then a few weeks later, I went to the GIR board, and they were all talking about uncertainty. And there is a thread running right through the work of the actuarial profession about the difficulty and the challenge we have in explaining uncertainty to other people. And a lot of it stems from this point estimate that we are continually forced to give people because it's what they want, what they need, what they're required to produce for a set of accounts or whatever. And so there are some real challenges out there. So thank you for mentioning that, Michael. My last comment was to notice that David, as well as being our author tonight, has claimed bragging rights on London bombings. So could I ask you please to join me in thanking our opener, our closer and our author. Those of you who contributed to the discussion, as usual, it would help us if you've got some notes, if you could hand them in to Maria at the back of the hall, to help us with the transcript. You will get a chance to have a look at your comments in writing before they get published in the journal. The next sessional meeting here at Staple Inn will take place at 5 p.m. on Monday, the 25th of April, when a discussion on a paper called Risk Management in a Fair Valuation World by Malcolm Kemp is scheduled to take place. I'd also like to draw your attention to a change of venue for the sessional meeting on the 23rd of May. This was originally planned to take place in Southampton, but it's now been rearranged to take place here at Staple Inn. And it will be the topic for discussion then will be around the retirement savings crisis and pensions reform. Right, I declare the meeting closed. Thank you.